This holiday, BMW has reunited three members of the family at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. The Agile X3, engineered for any adventure. The plug-in hybrid X5, commanding the streets with unmatched presence. And the all-electric i4, charging into the future with impeccable performance. Hurry in to find what powers your journey at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
97.1 FM Talk. On-demand audio.
Welcome back to the Mark Reardon Show on 97.1 FM Talk. Boy, that was a full 4 o'clock hour. Suze News, Paul Hall, and Frank Cusimano, appreciative of all of them joining, regardless of Mark being gone. You can go back and listen to those on the free Odyssey app once they're up later. Obviously, they're not right now because the one that will be podcasting them is still hosting. I am Ethan Hannaford. Sue Thomas is with me as well. And joining us in studio, always a pleasure to have on, the one and only Matt Pauly, KMOX Sports Person. Personality, pre- and post-game host for the Cardinals Radio Network and host of the Gas House Gang podcast. Matt, it's a pleasure as always.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Enjoy. I'm glad that you're getting to do this. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is fun to get the opportunity, and you know, we've worked together a lot, and it's fun to be on this side a little bit. So I got to start off with You sound a little bit tired. Sounds like you've been talking for a little while, and I've been made aware you've been hosting the Dave Glover Show over on KMOX last couple days.
Yeah, Bernie Miklas and myself did. It was kind of a sports-intensive Gas House Gang takeover edition of Dave Glover Show, so it sounded a little different than the normal DGS, but it was fun. If nothing else, yeah, I grew up reading and listening to Bernie, and we've been doing the Gas House Gang together, but there's only so much that you can really like connect with somebody when you talk to them for a few minutes on a video screen before the thing goes live. So to get to know Bernie a little bit over the last couple days more and more, and then do some radio with him, it's been a lot of fun.
I got to say that sounds really cool when it comes down to the legend Bernie Miklas. So congratulations to you on that and being able to do that. How was Christmas for you?
You know what? It was good because it was Christmas, and I've got two young daughters, and just watching them enjoy Christmas is awesome. I've got a 5-year-old and a 6-month-old, so one of them got to experience Christmas for a first time. But the day before, no, on the 23rd, my oldest daughter got strep throat.
Uh-oh.
On New Year's Eve, my wife got very, very sick.
Christmas Eve,
that's what I mean. On Christmas Eve, she got terribly sick. And then my youngest daughter got sick as well, where she had a temperature. So it was an interesting Christmas in the Paul. I was the only one not to get sick.
Pauly household is batting 1-for-4.
Yeah.
Not a great batting average. Well, probably league average at this point.
Petri dish, Pauly household.
That is no bueno. Is everyone back to health now?
Mostly. There was some doctor appointments this morning to try to get everybody back going. So,
okay. Yeah. All right. Well, we hope that the Pauly household.
How was yours?
It was great. Okay. It was great. First Christmas married.
Yeah.
So that was nice. We spent it with my family's home on the Illinois side, and then her family came in town yesterday. So Christmas part two tonight.
Okay.
So see what Santa Claus brought here after we get off. So looking forward to that. So I'm curious. Yesterday, December 26th, Ozzie Smith's 70th birthday. I just asked Cusimano this, and he had a pretty darn good story.
Okay.
Talked about some golfing with Ozzie Smith. This is his favorite memory that he has spent with the Wizard. And you have, you know, you've been all over the place, but you spend a good chunk of your life here in St. Louis. And I know that you were a fan of Ozzie's growing up. What is your favorite memory of Ozzie Smith?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question because, first off, it's been cool. Like in this job, I've gotten to know him a little bit, which is when you think about who Ozzie Smith is and him being, even before you're a baseball fan growing up, if you're in St. Louis in that time, you know who Ozzie Smith is. So my favorite baseball team of all time, the team that caused me to just fall in love with baseball and fall in love with the Cardinals, was that 96 team, which was his final year playing. And what I really remember about that year, he had a really good season that year, and he split time with Royce Clayton. But that year and that the final series of that year ended up being a really important thing for me, understanding St. Louis baseball and the way fans are. Because that year, the Cardinals, on the final home weekend of the year, it was Ozzie Smith weekend. And all three games were dedicated to Ozzie and what he was able to do. And I remember getting tickets and going to all three games and just thinking how cool it was that an individual could be honored in that way for three whole days. So this isn't an exact moment, but I think as I was young growing up, so in 96, I would have been 14 years old and I was still learning about Cardinal baseball. That was one of those weekends where I really saw what being a Cardinal fan really, really means, honoring a guy like Ozzie.
That is a really cool story, and that was pre-Ethan in the world, so yeah. I wasn't even aware that they had an Ozzie Smith weekend. I've seen the videos of his exit from the field of play. I mean, and it all looks absolutely amazing. And you think about it, you think of this legacy that is the St. Louis Cardinals Hall of Fame and the Red Jackets and all these guys coming through on opening day. And a lot of these big-name guys within the last 10 years, but even some of them more recently, you know, you think Stan, you think Red Shandies, mm-hmm. but then you go Lou and Bob Gibson and Bruce Sutter. A lot of them have passed away, and you think about it, not that he wasn't in that top tier, because he most definitely was, but now, I mean, at this point, as far as the great Cardinal Hall of Famers that kind of stand alone as the all-time greats, he's one of the few kind of right now that represents that for the Cardinals that are still living.
Yeah, opening day feels different with those guys that you just mentioned not being there. I mean, I can remember sitting at an opening day for the first time ever and hearing the fans go, Lou, mm-hmm. and asking my dad, like, what, why? And, you know, he explained it to me.
I thought they were booing the first time it happened.
A lot of people think that. It sounds that way. So I don't want to say that the Cardinals have a problem, but I think it's a difference where there's two things that are happening. There are some, you know, Albert's going to be in the Hall of Fame. Yachty's going to be in the Hall of Fame. I don't think Wainwright's going to get there, but I guess I could be a little bit wrong on that. I'd love to be wrong on that one. There's not as many of these like legendary type players that are around, and a lot of the alumni, not as many of them are staying in St. Louis post playing career as well. So that's something that is changing. I don't think it's changing for the good. Hopefully, with this next era of Cardinals baseball, we can get back to a lot more of those legendary type players being with the team.
We jump into some of the latest news. It's been a little bit slower, I guess, with the Christmas season these last several days. But prior to that, things were moving fast. We had the stuff with Nolan Arenado. Paul Goldschmidt becomes a New York Yankee. First, we'll start off with Goldie. I mean, we've known for the last couple of months that he was not going to return, that the Cardinals were moving on from him. But what a career that he had in St. Louis, Matt.
Yeah, and you're disappointed that they did not accomplish more from a postseason perspective,
no doubt.
With Goldschmidt and Arenado. But you talk about a guy who wore the birds on the bat the right way and always represented himself and the team well. He did that. And even last year, which was a down year for him, he still led the team in home runs. There's some things he has to clean up and get better at. He has to not swing at pitches out of the zone. He has to swing at pitches in the zone. But you look at some of the underlying numbers with bat speed, what happens when he makes contact. There's no guarantee that he has a bounce back year, but some of those numbers would say he is likely to have that, and there's going to be less pressure for him in New York. He's going to be down in the order. That could look like a one-year $12.5 million contract for the Yankees is absolutely nothing.
That's change.
Yeah. If it goes really bad really early and they had to like walk away from it, it would be nothing to them. But I think at the end of the season, there's a pretty good chance that they're going to look at that $12.5 million and feel like that was money pretty well spent.
And you think about a guy that is so mentally stable, and throughout the highs that we saw in 2022 in his MVP season to the struggles of last year and even some of the year before, I mean, the same guy mm-hmm. every day in the clubhouse regardless.
Yeah, and you know it as well as anybody because you were in the clubhouse after the vast majority of home games. He didn't like talking with the media, but he never ducked the media. He never refused to answer. He wasn't the best quote. Like his sound bites were not exactly the greatest sound bites.
Sorry,
in the
I tried the best
world.
I could.
No, well, you did as well as you could with what you were working with. If you ever got him like away from a microphone, it was a little bit different for sure. But he is just a stand-up guy from a leadership standpoint. He did a lot of things that people are not aware of. And I always kind of felt bad for both him and Arenado because last season there was so much attention on, well, the Cardinals need to bring in leadership into the clubhouse. What Goldschmidt and Arenado is not doing, it's not enough. I think I think that was an indictment on them that was not fair. I think they were leading in their own kind of way, and they just wanted people who were maybe a little bit more vocal, but that doesn't mean that those guys were not doing things from a leadership capacity.
I think the last time that you joined with Reardon and I on air was right before the Nolan Arenado stuff got really crazy. Now, at that point, the winter meetings had just concluded, and the Cardinals had made it clear that they were going to trade Arenado. And I think, and you had talked about how you expected this to happen really fast.
Yeah.
And you weren't entirely wrong, because a trade did happen. It just wasn't approved.
Right. And I don't know when it's going to happen now. Like, I was very confident at the time that this was something that was going to move very quickly, and I didn't think that he was still going to be a Cardinal by Christmas, and he's still a Cardinal, and we're past Christmas, and now I would think this thing is going to last into the new year. Although, like, if my phone went off right now and I got a notification that said Nolan Arenado has been traded to wherever, it would not shock me. It's a really unique situation, because we're still waiting for the Bregman thing to get figured out and where he's going to end up signing. There's teams that seemingly Arenado is the second choice, and until that first choice of Bregman ends up going somewhere. And the thing that's really frustrating is the amount of misinformation there is out there, because one report will say that the Cardinals have talked to the Yankees about it, and then one report will say, no, that's not the case at all, that there's absolutely no interest. And it's not just the Yankees. It's been that way. You know, one report will tell you that the Padres have interest in him, especially if he's willing to go over and play first base. Another report will tell you, well, the Padres are going to drop payroll this year, so that's not really possible. There's just been so many things where there's been two sides to the story, and each side of the story have been reputable, good, insiding reporting that you see guys breaking stories. So this is one where I don't think he's going to be a Cardinal next year. I'm pretty sure he's still going to get traded. But the turn that this has taken really post-winter meetings has been interesting.
You know, I think that something that is also a little bit interesting with this is that, you know, that John Mozeliak was able to get the deal that he specifically got. Now, we don't know the full details of what that trade included, but we know that the Astros or the Cardinals were going to eat a little bit of that contract, but not as much as I thought that they would necessarily have to. We don't know what the return would have been prospect-wise, but I think that, you know, as from what we know, that has to be a pretty good, I guess I would say, structure of a deal that you'd want to hopefully be able to make to happen eventually.
Maybe, unless the Astros were the only team that was willing to do that. That might be the holdup here, that there's not another team in baseball that's willing to eat all but $15 to $20 million of his contract. So at that point, you're the Cardinals. You say, well, do we just sit on this and see if there's a third baseman injury in spring training that lifts his value again? Do we try again at the trade deadline? Like, what? One of the things that really struck me when John Mozeliak was talking about this at the winter meetings, he said, look, we need to drop payroll, and we'd like to trade Nolan Arenado. That would accomplish that goal, but there's other ways we can do this. When he says there's other ways we can do this, so if we're talking about this from a position of reality, because that's how we need to come at it in reality.
Sure.
They are dropping payroll this year. So if you're a Cardinal fan and you want Nolan Arenado to remain a Cardinal, well, that means some other salary is going to come off the books. And that might mean it's more likely to trade Ryan Helsley. Who actually is more valuable to the Cardinals in terms of getting them wins? Is it Arenado or is it Helsley? Especially when you're still probably going to move on from Arenado at some point. There's a lot of people that say, well, trade Miles Michaelis. Well, Michaelis has a no trade. And I don't think he has shown any willingness at this point to waive the no trade. So for all the people that out there that want to, you know, send text messages into KMOX and want to you know, tweet back, oh, well, just trade Michaelis. Like, it's not that easy. And I don't know who's picking up Michaelis and who's going to pick up that salary. First, you know, he's been one of the two or three worst pitchers in baseball from an ERA standpoint over the last couple of years. So getting anybody to eat that salary is going to be challenging. And he has to approve a trade, which doesn't seem likely at this point.
Yeah, that's the toughest part about that, it seems. And it's going to be interesting to see where all of this goes with Nolan Arenado. And eventually, if, you know, we don't know if the Astros would even be an option at this point with the Christian Walker signing now. And, you know, those
that
teams
pushes Paredes back to third. There is no room for Arenado, because if Arenado goes there, Isak Paredes goes over to first base. Now that they've got Walker, there's no room at the end for Nolan Arenado.
Which makes you think, you know, makes you wonder, is he going to end up being back with the Cardinals. And I think that when Christian Walker signed with Houston, those odds had to at least a fair amount decrease back to there's a chance he stays with St. Louis.
Yeah, so the problem with that was when there's dominoes that need to fall in terms of the third baseman that are still out there and available. Well, a domino fell in Houston that closed off Houston, but you didn't reduce the number of third basemen that were available because it was a first baseman that basically closed off third base in Houston. So that was not a good scenario for the Cardinals because you want there to be more third base opportunities and less third basemen available, and that sort of situation does the exact opposite.
Yeah, couldn't agree with you more. Matt Pauly, before we wrap up here, we've talked about my podcast. I do the Loose Sports Talk, and on our Christmas season, we always get a little bit festive, and we do a Christmas wish list episode specifically for St. Louis sports. I'm curious, for whether it be the Cardinals, the Blues, heck, you can get into St. Louis City, the Battlehawks for all I care, is there something that you are hoping for specifically in 2025 that one of these teams can do that better projects them eventually to getting closer to a championship?
I mean, the obvious answer is with the Cardinals and getting player development and getting players role. But when you talk about 2025, you know, I want to see Chaffetz Arena just rocking with great SLU basketball. It is such
good one.
That's where I would go with this because it's going to take a little while longer, I think, for the Cardinals. We thought that SLU was going to like just turn a corner with shirts coming in and the players that he brought in. It's taken a little longer than anybody expected, but that there is something special in the city of St. Louis when SLU basketball is a top 25 team and their home arena is rocking.
I completely agree with that. Great points. Matt Pauly, where can people find the Gas House Gang podcast?
All the KMOX Sports social media channels. We do it live Monday through Friday. Not this week and the next week where, you know, it's holiday period, but once we come out of the holidays, we'll be back live at 12 noon on the social media channels. You can listen to the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, and then a replay generally is at 8 o'clock over on KMOX.
Pauly, a pleasure as always. Thanks so much for joining.
Anytime. Thanks, Ethan.
Coming up next, more Best Ofs right here on The Mark Reardon Show. On 97.1 FM Talk. Our best of segments resume after a busy hour and a half there. Big thanks to Matt Pauly for joining us in the previous segment. And now we go back to, like I said, our best ofs. Laura Gottesdiener is the next guest. Back in July, Mark had a really interesting interview with her. She's with Reuters Mexico, and she discusses some of the research that they were doing and what it took to find out how easy it really is to make millions off of fentanyl.
Sometimes you click on things on the internet. It's called clickbait because the headline's going to make you want to read the story. This one certainly did, and I think it's more than clickbait because this is rather stunning reporting from a team at Reuters. The headline, "We bought everything needed to make $3 million worth of fentanyl. All it took was $3,600 in a web browser." And Laura Gottesdiener is with us. She's one of the reporters that worked on this particular project. It certainly caught my attention last week. Laura, how are you? I understand you're in Mexico City as well. Is that true?
Yeah, I'm based up in Monterrey, Mexico, about 2 hours south of the Texas border. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, I thought this was pretty incredible reporting, and I want to explain, and want you to explain to the audience what happened here and how easy this was, because I think people are going to be stunned.
Sure. We spent about a year, contacting, Chinese chemical suppliers and really trying to dig into every aspect of this supply chain. And the thing that really surprised us after doing all of this reporting, which, you know, we're still working on future stories, is that it's really quite cheap and relatively easy to get your hands on these precursor chemicals. Precursor chemicals obviously being the types of chemicals that, you know, can be used in the illicit manufacture of fentanyl.
So you guys, when you get started, the way that the story describes it is that the reporter or a reporter had ordered the chemical 6 weeks earlier from a seller. The sales assistant, quote unquote, Jenny, used a photo of a Chinese actress as her screen avatar. The price was $440, payable in Bitcoin, interestingly enough, delivery by air freight included. And Jenny says, "We can ship safely to Mexico. No one knows what we ship." So how did that all go down then from there?
Sure. So we reached out, to dozens of different Chinese chemical sellers to, you know, see what they were selling, how much it cost, how they shipped, and we found not just Jenny, but many of them told us, you know, that they could ship safely either to the United States, directly into the United States, or to Mexico. And to find out whether, you know, that was really true, we actually did. We bought more than a dozen chemicals. A few turned out to be fake, but we ended up with a dozen chemicals that could be used to make fentanyl. Most of the transactions were in Bitcoin. As you know, that's cryptocurrency. And really, these were obviously, you know, transactions that on the one hand were very, very strange. You know, you're chatting in the middle of the night, at least in North America time, with people who, you know, you don't really know who they are or who they work for, what the company is behind them. But on the other hand, it was also very, very straightforward. You know, they're salespeople. They're selling chemicals. They want to know what chemical. Every chemical has a registered number. So you tell them what number. They tell you how much it costs and how to ship it. And, you know, it's a little bit, it's not like buying anything else, but at the end of the day, it arrived just in the same way that many of your Amazon packages could arrive.
Right. But Laura, one thing that's interesting here, and this is what makes it so tough to get a handle on this, is you guys report in the piece, is that a lot of these chemicals, these precursors that you're referring to, they're used by legitimate industries, right? Different products, et cetera.
Yeah, this is what makes it very, very difficult for governments and regulators. You know, the same chemicals that that people use to synthesize illicit fentanyl are used in the types of products that touch your everyday lives. So we're talking about plastics, we're talking about rubber, we're talking about the dye that makes your blue jeans blue. So think about the idea of trying to regulate all of the chemicals, or so many chemicals that are important for legal industries, not just in the United States, but many companies in the United States need these chemicals, but all over the world.
So I want you to kind of describe, because this is where it gets very interesting geopolitically. One of the lines from the story is this: the fentanyl business is largely a three-nation trading system, with the United States, Mexico, and China linked in a toxic triangle as the illicit drug's biggest consumer, manufacturer, and raw materials supplier. Go into a little bit more detail about that triangle, because that's rather fascinating, isn't it?
Sure. Thanks for picking up on that. So, you know, to start with the biggest consumer, obviously the United States is the largest consumer of illicit fentanyl in the world. And, you know, many governments around the world that are, you know, taking steps to regulate these products are also saying, hey, United States, you've got to take steps to rein in the demand. Obviously, the government is doing a lot of work on that front, investing more money than ever. But regardless, the United States is the largest consumer and has the most demand of illicit fentanyl. Next comes Mexico. According to U.S. officials, Mexico is the largest illicit manufacturer of fentanyl. And obviously from there, you know, it's smuggled usually through ports of entry by U.S. citizens into the United States. And then you get to China, which is, you know, it has the largest chemical industry in the world. The vast, vast, overwhelming majority of those products are used legally for illicit uses, again, for the types of products that allow you and I to live our everyday lives. But, you know, our reporting shows and, you know, officials tell us that it is also the largest supplier of these fentanyl precursor chemicals.
So is there a takeaway that you have at this point in the reporting? Because we've had issues here in Missouri, just like any other states, where this is maybe one of those undercovered tragedies where you have this being the top killer of young people ages 18 to 45, right? But cracking down on illegal fentanyl supply chains, that's not easy. You've kind of just proved that. Is there a way to do it effectively?
Yeah, I want to say, you know, on this point, I'm grateful to be on the reporting side and not on the policy side.
Right.
What we really wanted, and I don't mean to duck the question, but what we really wanted to show with this article is that despite an incredible amount of activity by law enforcement, not just in the United States, but at the international level and all around the world, the pipeline for these fentanyl precursor chemicals is still quite open. These precursor chemicals are still cheap and easy to obtain. So, you know, from here, we really wanted readers, and we know it's a long story, but we wanted readers to think after they read the end of the full story, you know, what is the best way for us to save lives in the United States? Because we are losing, as you know, tens of thousands of people a year to fentanyl overdoses. And everyone agrees that one death is too many, and approximately 75,000 overdose deaths from synthetic drugs, synthetic opioids, that's far too many.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. It really is. And again, you know, I feel like it's something we talk about in passing. We have these terrible numbers that are up there, and then you have families living these, you know, horrible tragedies in the background, feeling kind of, you know, hopeless, I think. And you know, here's one question for you. Have you had, outside of, you know, talk show hosts in St. Louis and media people, Laura, have you had, has this reporting drawn the interest of any members of Congress, et cetera?
Yeah, we've been getting a lot of feedback from the story. I can't name specific people, but we're quite aware that, you know, from Washington to law enforcement agencies all around the country to, you know, agencies in different countries as well, people are taking notice of the story. But, you know, I want to say this is, you know, we wanted to really show, you know, firsthand how this works. We're the first news organization to buy these chemicals, to test these chemicals, to show step-by-step how this pipeline works. But I will say, you know, law enforcement in the United States, they know this is a problem, and they're working on it. And we really wanted to show this for everyday readers. You know, why is there a supply that seems so difficult to get a handle on for the chemicals that fuel this very deadly drug?
And then I guess the final question, you're down in Mexico City, right? But what's the reaction from the Mexican government on some of this reporting, or what did you find out for them? Because the cartels are heavily involved in this as well, aren't they?
You know, our reporting, not just on this story, but, you know, we've done a lot in our bureau. We've done a lot of reporting on the Mexican cartels. You know, they are obviously heavily involved in illicit fentanyl manufacture, according to U.S. authorities. For them, you know, it's a lucrative industry. And I think, you know, the title of the headline, you know, that you read out explains why. I mean, we spent $3,600 and had an internet connection, and we got enough precursor chemicals to make $3 million worth of fentanyl, obviously. And I want to make it very clear from readers, we did not make fentanyl. We did not take any steps to making fentanyl. But certainly, you know, anyone can kind of do the back of the envelope math on that and understand why those who are engaged in this illicit industry, you know, are reaping very good profits right now.
Well, Laura, I'm always looking for interesting and thorough reporting, and you certainly provided that with this story. I found it intriguing, horrifying, and maybe we can get some, you know, some answers in the future and some more motivation to fix some of this. But thanks for coming on in St. Louis here tonight. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
It's Laura Gottsteiner, who is with Reuters. That is a crazy, crazy story, I'll tell you what. And I will say, you know, again, giving a little credit where credit is due, some actual reporting from journalists,
yes,
which is a little
nice.
Rare these days.
I liked what Kilmeade said earlier on OJ.
Well, not for me to judge, but if he doesn't burn in hell, who will? I mean, clearly he killed someone in cold blood and tortured his ex-wife while she was alive, and she feared for his life. We have the recordings. We can go back and listen to him. She did everything except beg for help. And then he got away with it, but then lived a life in purgatory where everyone looked at him, saw a murderer. And then it was the first time, really, we talked about race to this degree in America, where we almost get familiar, more familiar with the topic, with the George Floyd, and a little bit prior to that.
You know, and I'm telling you, it was disgusting. I used to see him at Churchill Downs Derby weekend all the time, and he loved it. He just was smiling. And this is after the trial, of course.
Oh,
and people would surround him and sign autographs, et cetera. One of the first people I thought about this morning was my friend John Ziegler, who is the host of the podcast The Death of Journalism out in Los Angeles. Because, Zig, as I remember, you have a very unusual connection to O.J. Simpson and his story, right?
Well, yeah, I do, actually. I mean, a lot of people have a connection to this case, but I think mine is pretty unique, and it's varied. I dated the sister of Ron Goldman for quite a while, rather seriously. We were very good friends, and that was part of my connection to the case. And because of my relationship with Kim Goldman, I played a pretty significant role in why O.J. Simpson ended up in prison in Nevada, which people don't understand was as a direct result of the libel verdict against him for having killed Ron Goldman and Nicole Brown Simpson after he was acquitted in the criminal case. And so I've had confrontations in person with O.J. I think, you know, there was a strategy behind all that, which ended up resulting in what happened in Nevada. And I'm actually quite proud of that. But, you know, I'm absolutely in the camp of people who are happy today that O.J. Simpson is finally dead. He should have died in prison. And it's astonishing to me that there are a lot of people on Twitter, seemingly smart people, who are still trying to hang on to this idea that he might not actually have been guilty of the murders. And the New York Times is saying that the murders ruined O.J.'s life, which is just unbelievable, and the Heisman Trophy people are mourning his passing, and it's absolutely bizarre to me. I thought we had established that we understood that O.J. Simpson was guilty, but apparently not in this crazy world in which
we live. Wow, I haven't seen a lot of that, and that's very distressing. Even, did you hear KJP?
Our thoughts are with his families during this difficult time, obviously with his family and loved ones. And I'll say this, I know that they have asked for some privacy, and so we're going to respect that.
Okay, I don't hold any animus against his family, but good Lord,
hold on a second. Wait, that's unbelievable. Well, hold on. Let's be clear about this. All right, now look, obviously people have sympathy for the kids because they were young and their mother got slaughtered. But let's be clear about what happened that night. O.J. Simpson slaughtered their mother at their front door, where if it not for a miracle, his own children would have found her beheaded.
That's right.
Outside their house. That's what would have likely happened if not for a dog passing by and finding the blood. I mean, it's unbelievable. And then and he dies out of prison with his children by his side? Oh, my God.
I don't get it. The whole thing is so confusing. Like I said this earlier, John. I've worked with people here, African-Americans, that have thought, you know, that he's not guilty. And it's stunning to me that you're saying that some of this is going on right now.
Well, look, the case is so clear-cut. I don't know how much time you have, but I think I can explain why he's guilty in a fairly short period of time without any of the normal controversial stuff. All people need to understand is the testimony of the limo driver. Do you remember the limo driver, by any chance? Alan Park was his name.
Oh, yeah.
So O.J. was supposed to go to the airport that night of the murders, right? So he has a limo driver pick him up at Rockingham. He had never been to Rockingham before, so he was looking for the address of Rockingham on the curb. You know, the numbers on the curb,
yes,
okay?
Yes, yes.
So when he comes to Rockingham, he sees the number that he's looking for. I'm at the right place. He turns the corner, and he parks in the parking area, and he rings for O.J., but no one answers. So he's sitting there waiting for O.J., who's supposed to get the limo to go to LAX. Well, the reason why this is incredibly important is that the next morning, the white Ford Bronco was found hastily parked right where Alan Park would have been looking for the number on the curb. I have been on that street, Mark. It is the most narrow street I have ever seen in my life. There's no chance in the world that Alan Park was driving a white limo and didn't realize that there was a white Ford Bronco blocking the curb. The car wasn't there.
Yeah.
And if it's not there,
O.J. is not there.
Guilty.
Yes.
Because, one, he's lying about where he was. That means he came in after Park had already arrived, and the doors were locked to the Bronco, and the victim's blood was inside the car. That's it.
I know. I can't even believe that there was unbelievable amount of evidence. And, you know, we even, Mark Cox, who's our morning guy here, Sue, pull up that tweet, because Cox was a TV reporter here at CBS affiliate KMOV Channel 4, and he covered it at the time. And he reminded us, and you'll remember this too, and I was in Paris when all this happened, so I didn't see the reaction as much here. I watched some CNN, you know, in a hotel room. But there were, what did Mark say? He said,
Mark says, O.J. Simpson, blah, 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 Ron Goldman. There was no one I talked to who covered it, who was not convinced of his guilt, but the crowds in front of the courthouse cheered like they'd won the lottery when he was acquitted.
Wild cheering, right?
All because the glove didn't fit.
Well, see, that's the part of the case that really enrages me. It's not just the fact that two people were slaughtered, and I have a connection to the Goldman family, and I know Fred Goldman a little bit, and you know that, and so I've seen that part of the damage here. But from a culture perspective, the race angle on this thing created enormous destruction in our society that we are still suffering from today. 100%. O.J. Simpson was the last person on the planet who should have benefited from whatever history of racism we've had in this country regarding the judicial system. That was what enraged me initially before I got involved in the case. This is the guy who benefits because black men may have been convicted of crimes they didn't commit in the past. This is the guy The guy who had his ass kissed by every police officer in Los Angeles because he was O.J. frickin' Simpson. I mean, it's absolutely unbelievable, the upside-down world we live in. And Johnny Cochran played the race card, and it worked because it was jury nullification. The jury did not care about the facts. They did not care about the logic. This was payback, whether it was for Rodney King or for whatever. This was a gross injustice, and we are still suffering from the divide that that created today.
You've summed it up quite well. I said earlier, I've said this for, you know, all this time since the trial, and maybe it's just me that feels this way, although I think if you watch the video, when the verdict comes in, watch Kardashian's face, Robert Kardashian's face. He looks like he's getting ready to puke because I feel like he was overwhelmed with guilt of what he just did in letting a killer roam free.
That's true, and that's also another part of the legacy of this case. Without this case, we never have the Kardashian girls. Kim Kardashian is never famous. We have none of those. None of that ever happens. I mean, there's so many different tentacles to this case, but the Kardashian angle is one of them.
Well, John, thanks for jumping on here this afternoon, because I absolutely appreciate your passion on this, and I'm glad you shared the story.
Well, that wraps up all of our best of segments for the day. That was John Ziegler speaking with Mark last April on his fascinating connection with O.J. Simpson. It has been a fun show. Sue, thank you so much for joining me and hanging out today.
Mm-hmm.
Greatly appreciate it. And we are back on Monday as we continue on with the best of segments of 2024. You're listening to The Mark Rudin Show on 97.1 FM Talk.
Get more at 971talk.com.